Chicago's number one destination for sports.
Now and always, this is Sportsnet 960, The Fan.
It is 9:04. I'm thinking if we wanted to, me and you, we could swing a whole whack of trades today. So what do we? So we're gonna get Nino Niederreiter. What are we? What are we giving up? I just want to write this down. So Nino
for Brody.
Yeah.
And a third.
Okay.
And a second next year.
Okay. And a second in 2014. Word coming down from the Detroit Red Wings: Ian White is out 2 to 3 weeks. Grief.
So Noah Lidstrom, Jakob Kindle still out. Ian White is now out. Carlo Koliakovo. Oh, big shock. Good heavens. He's out.
So they just signed Kent Huskins yesterday.
They signed Kent Huskins. Brian Lashoff was called up and scored the other day. He's back in Grand Rapids now.
They need some defensive help.
Badly.
Who are we going to trade them?
Jay Bouwmeester.
All right. What are we getting back?
Gimme. Nyquist and Pulkkinen. Gimme.
That's what you want off of Detroit? What about Filppula? Don't you want
to? You're not getting Filppula.
He's in the last year of his deal.
No, he. Well,
he's going to market, baby.
You're not getting him.
I bet you are.
They'll re-sign him.
I bet you are.
No, if you can get Filppula for Jay Bouwmeester, you do that deal like yesterday.
I think there's a deal to be made there.
If you can get Filppula for Jay Bouwmeester, then do it. This is a story. Then.
All right, I'm going to do it because they're going to do it. They're desperate.
Sure. And give me Pulkkinen. Gimme.
You're not getting Pulkkinen.
Why not? They're not all going to play. Tatar and Pulkkinen and Nyquist. Listen, Mrsak? Okay, give me Mrsak.
All right.
Can I have Mrsak?
No.
Okay, give me...
It's too much.
Give me Tatar.
You can have Tatar.
Okay.
All right. So what does that leave you on the blue line in Calgary?
Babchuk and Smith.
And Chris Breen. All right. We're going to be hooking up with Goose Gossage here momentarily. He is in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Going to be in town, Calgary.
Jay Leach.
The, why? He's going to be coming to the UFC dinner, the fundraiser. They always bring in a big name, and we've been lucky enough to get him in advance of that. The Dinos Baseball and Fastball Clubs. 22 seasons, 9 major league teams from 72 to 94. The keynote speaker at the Dinos fundraiser on Thursday night, the 31st of January, to help out. Best known for his years with the Yankees and Padres, one of the top relievers in baseball throughout the 70s and 80s. He was one of those guys, too, and I don't know if it started there, and we could certainly ask him about it, but he's kind of known for the mustache, much like, you know, like Lanny. I don't know if it's quite the same as Lanny, but certainly when Gossage was on, he had the big handlebar. Was one of the first guys, or it seemed like he was kind of one of those guys that the intimidation, the way you looked, and the demeanor that you had on the mound was almost as important as the velocity of your fastball. The ability to get into hitters' kitchens when you were getting set to try and close out a game. Stops in Chicago, both teams, Pittsburgh, San Fran, Texas, and Oakland, and then retired as a Mariner in 1994. Again, dating myself. Feels like he was in, like, 94? Jeez. So we'll talk to Goose Gossage in a moment. So we've traded J-Bo and TJ Brody and a bunch of picks.
Yeah.
Second we don't have, so now you've got a first but no second and no third in this draft, and next year you've got no second again.
Correct. But you have, I mean, let's be honest. It depends on the guys. You're not bringing in, you know, guys that... Like, Nino Niederreiter, right? If you could re-enter the draft, Nino Niederreiter's eligible for the draft, he'd go in the first round. Right? He might not go fifth overall, but he'd go in the upper half of the first round. Right? So there's value to be had there.
That's
And you know, you're saving, if you believe in him, you're saving 2-3 years on development.
And to me, that's the thing. Even if you wanted to have that conversation, right? About a first. Now, I know you're deathly afraid that the wheels come off in Calgary and all of a sudden you get into the top five.
Hey, Toronto did it, right? Toronto did it. Brian Burke thought they were going to contend for the playoffs. He traded away that first. It's Tyler Seguin, franchise player. It's too. You can't do it. Not for Nino Niederreiter, you can't.
It's a caution. It's a definite cautionary tale. Yeah, because when they traded for Phil Kessel, they traded a couple picks, as we all know, turned into Sagan and Dougie Hamilton. They traded for Phil Kessel. Kessel already had 30 goals.
Sure, and Kessel gets a bad rap because of that deal. He's been good in Toronto. He's been really good in Toronto.
Yeah.
Scores a ton of goals.
He was a point-a-game guy last year, 30 goals every single season. Yeah, it's difficult to do, isn't
it? Yeah, you're not doing the first. And I don't think they can ask a first. They could ask a first from, say, Pittsburgh. But why does Pittsburgh want to do that?
To the Subway Restaurants Fresh Take Hotline we go. 22 seasons, 9 Major League teams, and the Baseball Hall of Fame. He is coming to town to help raise a little bit of money, a little fundraiser for the Calgary of Dinos Baseball and Fastball Clubs. Rich Goose Gossage joining us on the phones. Goose, how are you?
Good, guys. How are you?
We're fantastic. I guess, welcome to Calgary when you get here. Welcome to Calgary. Tell me about, are you a big, do a lot of these speaking engagements?
Yeah. I get around and enjoy doing what I do, and it's all that's left, guys. I'm over the hill as a pitcher, and I'm still throwing as hard, it's just not going as fast, guys.
That's how it goes, right? Never take that away from you. Hey, you know what? I was wondering just where, because you had the mustache, and we were kind of talking about it. Now to be a closer, to be a reliever in Major League Baseball, you got to have goofy hair and beards and tattoos, and you got to wear your stuff a little bit different. Were you maybe one of the first guys? How much of the mustache and the look was a part of the intimidation factor for you?
Well, it ended up, I didn't have a mustache until 1981, and that was, I had 11 years or 12 years in the big leagues at that time, and we couldn't grow mustaches past the corner of our mouth with the Yankees, and I grew a beard in the off season, and it showed up at spring training with a beard, and of course, Mr. Steinbrenner wouldn't allow beards for sure, and nothing past the corner of your mouth, so Yogi was in charge of hair. And when I showed up at camp with a beard, I was hanging my clothes up in my locker, my gear, and Yogi shows up and he goes, "Hey, you gotta shave that crap off. George will go crazy." So I said, "I'm gonna shave it off. I just thought I'd keep the beard just to show the guys what I'd grown on the off season." Went in the bathroom and left the Fu Manchu. I came out just to bust Yogi's chops. I wasn't even going to keep a mustache and thought I just kept this Fu Manchu to bust Yogi's chops. And I thought, hey, I kind of like that. Well, I came out and Yogi said, "Hey, it's going to be cut right here. Georgie's going to kick my ass." So, and he was in charge. George had Yogi Berra in charge of hair.
Yeah.
So I ended up thinking, hey, I kind of like the Fu Manchu. And as the season progressed in 81, we went back to a World Series. I was having a great year, and by the time the World Series rolled around, I had this full-blown Fu Manchu, and, you know, it was good timing. I was, like I said, we had a great year, and we were having a great year, and I was having a terrific year, and George didn't say a word. So that's how it evolved.
Well, and isn't it funny, because now it's almost commonplace, right? I mean, Dennis Eckersley and then Mitch Williams and Rod Beck, and you just go down the list, and Mitch Williams in there. Every closer had some sort of, you know, weird demeanor or guys doing some weird stuff on the mound. In terms of the modern day closer, A, intimidation, and B, you know, just that guy that would pitch the ninth inning. This never used to exist. I mean, guys used to go complete games all the time. Those will be records that'll never be broken. You were one of the first.
Well, you know, the whole pitching, the aspect of pitching is really upside down. That's why I'm not coaching. I don't believe in 100 pitch counts, and they protect these guys to the point that I really think they don't build up the arm strength that we used to have. And, you know, I used to be a workhorse, man. I didn't just pitch the ninth inning. And, you know, when that starter got in trouble, starters still prided themselves on finishing what they started, and they would try to go 9 innings. Well, when they got in trouble in the 6th or the 7th inning, I was brought in to get out of that jam, to clean up the mess, and then to pitch the 8th and the 9th or whatever was left in the game. So, you know, at the time when I was being, you know, considered for the Hall of Fame, the vote would come out 8. It took 9 years for me to get in, and after I was eligible, and all I would ever try to point out is, please don't compare me with these one-inning guys today, because that's not the way it was. I saw the total evolution of the bullpen when I was put in it in 1972. My first year in the big leagues was a junk pile where old starters went to the bullpen was an old junk pile where old starters starters went that couldn't start anymore. So, but it had started to evolve, and heck, I was in the big leagues and I'd do anything. And then I became to love that position, being able to come to the ballpark, you know, every night with the opportunity to pitch in a big ball game.
There must have been, and like you say, the Hall of Fame vote, and people would, you know, look at it a little bit differently. When this first started, like you say, entering the game in the seventh or the eighth, or certainly the eighth, and then finishing up in the ninth, were you razzed a little bit? Because, like you say, the mindset then is far different than what it was now. I'm just curious what, you know, opponents would have been saying to you as far as pitching one inning a night, potentially.
Well, if I ever did get I got a few of one-inning saves, man, the guys were all over me. Like, you're going to take that save, you know, and now it's the norm. You know, now it takes three guys to do what I did and Fingers did and Suter did and Lee Smith did. So, you know, it's totally different. And they say Mariano's the greatest relief pitcher ever. Well, you know, I say this, do what we did, and then we'll compare apples to apples.
We look forward to getting you on, you know, simply because of story time, and you know, you've won a World Series, and looking at the big games that you have been in, and the big moments, I mean, it's hilarious. It's like your Forrest Gump always popping up in these. The Bucky Dent game, you were there. The George Brett Pine Tar game, you were right there. You faced Pete Rose in his final at-bat ever. Let's start with the George Brett thing. It's one of the most memorable scenes, I think, in baseball history. Him flying out of the dugout, thought he was going to kill somebody. Take us through that moment.
Yeah. I'm glad he didn't have a gun.
He was hot.
Oh, my God, it's the maddest human being I think I've ever seen. But, you know, people ask me who the greatest hitter was that I ever faced. You know, I got to face a lot of great hitters on the backsides of their careers, and meaning Aaron and Al Kaline and Frank Robinson and those kinds of hitters, Tony Oliva, who I believe belongs in the Hall of Fame. But, you know, it was George Brett was the greatest hitter that I ever faced when he was in his prime and my prime. And you just mentioned one shot that he heard, a shot that was heard around the world, the Pine Tar home run. And then he hit another home run off me into the upper deck at Yankee Stadium in 1980 they went on to be world champions. You know, he hit an upper deck home run off me that was the last nail in our coffin during that season. So, he was the greatest hitter. And, yeah, absolutely, that was a Nettles spotted the Pine Tar. It wasn't Billy Martin. It was Greg Nettles that spotted the Pine Tar. Thurman Munson had been called out on the same thing a few years prior to that. And so Nettles saw George's bat being covered all the way up on the barrel with pine tar, and we were just sitting and waiting for him to get a big hit off of us so we could call him on it. And then the umpires checked the bat, laid it down on home plate, and signaled him out, and that's when he charged out of the dugout. And we ended up, the league ended up, you know, overruling the rule book because it had it in the rule book, but they said it really didn't have anything to do by propelling that ball into the seats. But, you know, he was using an illegal bat. We called him on it. The umpires did their job, called him out, and then Lee McPhail overruled it, and I ended up getting that loss. But, it's for sure one of the most interesting things in the history of the game.
I'm fascinated by the George Brett thing, and I'll ask you, you know, why? Why was he the best hitter you ever faced? What made him so good? Because there's tons of great hitters throughout baseball, you know, Tony Gwynn, Barry Bonds, but these guys are all different. What made George Brett so great?
Well, you know, Tony Gwynn was more of a singles guy, and he could hit for power if he wanted to, but he would have sacrificed that average. George Brett, man, this guy just did what you needed to get done in the late, you know, late in a ball game. And God, he was a Yankee killer. He, I don't know how many home runs he hit off of Catfish and the rest of the staff, but man, he was a single-handedly, just a wrecking crew himself. I don't know what made him so great. I think he will go down. You know, you talk about great hitters and you know, Ted Williams and now, you know, we just lost Stan Musial, who was the greatest gentleman. I think the game is one of the greatest gentlemen the game has ever known, for sure. And we're going to miss him, dearly. And he certainly will go down as one of the greatest hitters. And I think as time goes on, you're going to look at Brett as being in that category of the greatest hitters in the game. And I, you know, hand-eye coordination, I really don't. He worked at it. Charlie Lau really helped him become the greatest hitter. I know that he will get a lot of credit from George, Charlie Lau would, by being a great hitting instructor and helping George become one of the greatest hitters.
Chatting with Goose Gossage, he is coming to town, part of a UFC fundraiser dinner, our guest here on Sportsnet 960, The Fan. There's something very pure to me about the way you would have played the game and the way you did play the game. You're a fastball guy. This was not it was not about mechanics. It was not about outthinking. This was, I'm going to throw the ball and I'm going to blow it by you. If you can hit it, good on you, but I bet you're not going to. I mean, there's a certain mentality, and I would think, you know, balls or whatever you want to call it, to stand up there with the game on the line and just have the belief in your stuff that you're going to be able to blow it by a guy.
Well, confidence is everything. But I was always a power pitcher, and I lasted a long time being a power pitcher. Normally, power pitchers don't last that long. But you take a guy like Nolan Ryan, myself, we had great mechanics that really helped us with longevity. And, you know, of course, genetics plays a part in that too. But really, you can have the greatest genetics. If you've got bad mechanics, your arm's going to fall off sooner, you know, probably sooner than later. So it's just one of those things that I was blessed with a great arm. And I had no fear, and to go out there, sometimes I would go out there and what you saw is what you got. Nothing was premeditated or the way I acted out there, and I just went about my business. I was all business, and the stare and the looking in, and I would look at hitters and I would think, man, I would not want to be this guy right now. And that happened a lot throughout my career. You know, guys out there on the mound and in professional sports, you either eat or you get eaten. I was very competitive. I was a tough competitor, at 100-mile-an-hour fastball, and I was just wild enough. I had great command of that 100-mile-an-hour fastball, which really helped me, but I was just wild enough that once in a while one would get away, and it kept everybody loose, and they were not going to dig in against me. And, you know, I had a lot of things going for me. I hit the ball very well in my delivery. I threw hard. My ball moved. I had great movement on it. So I had a lot of intimidation, and I just had a lot of things going for me, guys.
Now, you profess that while you would come inside and try and keep, earn your space, you rarely, if ever, threw intentionally at a guy.
No, guys, balls got away enough that it really just kept in, and nobody, I wasn't even looking where I was throwing. It was a crazy windup, and I just tried to throw the ball as hard as I could, and I had great control with that in mind. And it was just one of those things that, guys, I scared myself out there. I would not have wanted to face me. And Dick Allen took me under his wing early on in my career, my first year in the big leagues, and taught me how to pitch and make pitches or show me where to make pitches on guys that they couldn't handle it. And he said, no matter if you can tell them it's coming, then they're not going to be able to hit it. And that was a pitch that was up in the strike zone and on the inside part of the plate, inside corner of the plate, and in that area, middle half in and up, letter high. And when I missed right there, and he taught me this, when I missed that perfect pitch, pit hitters see it like a basketball coming up there, and they got to pull the trigger, and they can't hold off of that pitch because they see it so well. and they know they got to get the barrel of the bat there, or they're not going to make contact with it. And God couldn't hit that pitch, and Dick taught me that. And it was an education from a greatest player that I ever had the privilege of playing with, and that's quite a statement. Because I played with a lot of great hitters and great players throughout my career, the 9 teams that I played on. But Dick Allen was the greatest, and that education, all the money in the world couldn't have paid for that coaching that Dick gave me from a great hitter standpoint.
How close are you to the game today? Do you follow it, you know, like a religion still, or is it once a Yankee, always a Yankee kind of thing? Where's your mindset at today?
Yeah, I think it is. I think once you know, I grew up out here in Colorado, and you know, I really, really loved and enjoyed playing for every team that I played for. But playing with the Yankees was very special. I grew up a Yankee fan, along with my whole family out here in Colorado. We didn't get that much exposure at the time to baseball. We didn't have the Colorado Rockies. We had a couple of Denver Bears, minor league, AAA. Of different affiliate, they were affiliated with different major league teams, and so we didn't get that much exposure. But we grew up Yankee fans, and then getting to play for them, and then winning a world championship, and then, you know, gosh, guys, being elected to the Hall of Fame has been such a humbling thing. To be even considered, I couldn't even believe that, you know, when the smoke cleared, my career was over, that I would even be considered for the Hall of Fame. And to be considered was such an honor. And then to go in, you know, to the Hall of Fame, be elected to the Hall of Fame, was something that I still can't really put my arms around. And then to go in as a Yankee was, gosh, even that much more special. So, you know, guys, I said it was like my career was like getting on, you know, a 10-year-old kid going to Disneyland for the first time and Disney World for the first time and waiting in a 2-hour line to get on his favorite ride or her favorite ride. And, you know, and it lasts 2 minutes. My favorite ride lasted 22 years, and I still, really, guys, I have to pinch myself that I had that kind of career, and the fans were so awesome. And without the fans, we wouldn't have a game. So we need to take these young kids need to know that they need to take care of those fans because they are what the game is all about.
It's been a treat talking to you, man. Obviously, one of the greatest of all time, very much deserving of being in the Hall of Fame, and I know people here in Calgary have been buzzing about it, and we look forward to it coming up on next Thursday, January 31st, at the Red and White Club. Thanks for doing this,
Great. Goose. I'm looking for all the fans. Come out and get an autograph and say hi, and I look forward to meeting everybody that comes to that banquet. I appreciate it, guys.
Thanks, Goose.
You bet, guys.
He's Goose Gossage, Major League Hall of Famer, 22 seasons, 9 major league teams, 72 to 94. And you're talking about an evolution of the game over that amount of time, and really kind of one of the pioneers of the reliever and the closer position. 9-time All-Star, just over 1,000 games, just over 1,500 strikeouts, 310 saves, led the AL in saves 3 times. Because of that unbelievable gas, upwards of 102 miles an hour.
Baseball is amazing, man. It's never changed. It's still 90 feet and still 60 feet, 6 inches, but so much has changed. And you look, you know, back in the day, you know, Walter Johnson and Cy Young, and even later on, a guy like, you know, Fergie Jenkins. Those guys went 9 innings, right? You started a game, you finished a game. And it's unheard of. If you have 4 or 5 complete games in a season now, you are an absolute horse. And it's amazing to see, whether it's just science or strategy or whatever, how it's changed. And he was really one of the first closers, you know, to bring in a guy for 1 inning to finish off a game or to get out of a jam was kind of new.
Again, this is coming up Thursday, January 31st at McMahon Stadium, the Red and White Club. It's the UFC Dinos annual fundraising dinner supporting the Dinos men's baseball and women's fastball clubs. If you would like tickets to go and see Goose Gossage and hear his stories, I have a feeling we just kind of tip of the iceberg there. Tickets for the event are still available. You can get tables of 8. You can call the Kinesiology Client Services. Kinesiology. 403-220-70.
Didn't you take that first semester before you
absolutely
quit?
Yeah, it was my minor. I majored in nachos, minored in kinesiology.
Majored in keggers.
403-220-7749. We'll step away, come back. More news in the Flames at Canucks tonight at Rogers Arena in Vancouver. Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Trending now. Now on Sportsnet 960 The Fan. Your morning show previews Flames Canucks tonight. The Jays at DeRosa. And I can't wait for Kate Upton's Super Bowl commercial. She's so much hotter than Manti Te'o's fake dead ex-girlfriend. It's all trending now on Sportsnet 960 The Fan. The beautiful game has returned, and it's going to come fast and furious. Sportsnet has the NHL covered on every platform. Back to your morning show with Boomer, Rhett, and Walker. Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
It's a shortened season now. Aginla's in his last year of his deal. Everybody believes that this guy doesn't want to go anywhere, but he also likes his money as well. And I think for him to hit, he's going to leave a ton of money on the table if he stays in Calgary. A ton. I think this guy's got the potential to sign 3 or 4 year deal at $7 million. He can make almost $30 million in 4 years.
But don't you think they'll give that to him?
No, I don't. And I don't think that they should, because it serves them no purpose for the next generation coming up. Yeah. Better start getting some wins under their... They got to alleviate it, because it's just going to start building in Calgary.
Nick Kyprios of Sportsnet.
Sounds like the discussion we have on a daily basis.
Welcome to welcome to Calgary Radio, Nick Kyprios. Good to talk to you.
Did I say all that?
Yeah.
I talk way too much.
It's funny how, you know what, we always kind of, when you guys kind of talk about the Flames or whatever, it's almost like you're kind of eavesdropping on your neighbors. Like, hey, I think they're talking about Aginla. What are they saying? Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, it's almost like when you're on an airplane and you hear somebody talking about somebody you know. It's not a conversation that certainly hasn't been had in this city. What do the Flames do with Jerome Aginla? I know that the team and the player they've come out, they've said, we're not talking about the contract, we're not talking about the future. I think there's an appetite from the team to keep the player, but the overriding question, I think, as you kind of got into it, what's best for everybody involved? It's, you know, there's a lot of pride and there's loyalty and all of that, but does it make sense to the Flames? Does it make sense to the player to have this marriage continue?
Well, I've been saying that for at least over 12 months now, in terms of what direction the Flames truly need to go. Well, you know, short term, you do nothing but prepare for the Vancouver Canucks. And Jerome, again, is a key guy. If they're going to start getting some wins, he's got to get going. They need a good start out of Aginla. And a couple games in, you know, no one's writing anybody off on bad starts. But you go 0-3 and Aginla's 0-4 in the goal department, that's a bad start. So this is a huge game tonight. And that's short term. Long term, I've said it to a lot of people now that if the barometer is Shane Doan, and I like Shane Doan, I really do, but when I see the appetite to sign Shane Doan this past year, and I compare it to Aginla, I say it's no contest. You look at Aginla's numbers compared to Shane Doan's numbers, and it's not even close. So if someone was offering Shane Doan $7 million, for 4 years, I certainly have no problem with Aginla earning that or more on a team that's contending. Is Calgary going to give them that type of money? If they are, why? Why would they do that? When you're telling Jerome we're paying you to win now, when we know that they really can't win now.
Nick, the secondary question is always, you know, what value do you place on having that pillar, even, you know, just looking in from the outside. Danny Alfredson's not leaving Ottawa, and Matt Sundin, as you know, it was kind of an unceremonious, awkward ending in Toronto.
Well, that's the danger. I don't even compare the situation of Aginla and Alfredson as the same. Alfredson is a hit away from shutting it right down. There's a level of frustration in his inability to stay completely healthy. There's concussion issues. It's not even close. Aginla will play another 3 or 4 years if he chooses to. The danger here, and we've seen it a couple times, not just Matt's in Toronto where it kind of got ugly, and you know, at the time, I think the Leaf organization was really hoping that he would come to the conclusion that he wanted to leave, and he never did. And that was a huge problem, is that the Leafs knew what the right thing to do was. But, you know, when you got a guy that's been a pillar in your organization and the career point leader on an original six team, you don't push him out the door. So they didn't, and they missed the window of opportunity to... I guarantee you, if Mats would have lifted his no-trade clause when there was still value, the Leafs wouldn't be in this mess right now. They'd be a hell of a lot better. And I think the quickest way for Calgary now to dig out of a hole here is to grab a couple of first-rounders or whatever highly touted prospect that you can build around in the next 2 or 3 years. They'll be better for it. But the question is, you know, is it a mutual agreement, or does one side dig in their heels and miss another window of opportunity?
Well, and that's the question that that we've had here for a long time, is the... If you want to maximize the asset to get the most back for Drome, those days look to be gone. But I wonder now, with so much emphasis and there's so much pressure to win, and it's a shortened season, and that, what do you anticipate could be a return on Jerome again? If in fact he does start scoring, and he will. I mean, it's just a matter of time. He's a bit of a slow starter. But what do the Flames get? And I mean, is it a situation where you take whatever you can get?
I don't think they're in a position still to get take whatever you can get here. I really believe, and I would have thought maybe, you know, that a player in his mid-30s now wouldn't get the value that probably he could have got maybe a couple of years ago. But his numbers are off the charts still. They really are. When you look at the consistency, and I know he's gone through stretches where it hasn't looked good, but 30 goals, 40 goals, you know, he's hit the number 50 on a couple occasions, but he is still a very consistent player. And I would have thought the value might have gone down, but again, I look no further to Shane Doan, and the action on Shane Doan was phenomenal, guys. In the free agent market, teams wanted him bad, and his numbers aren't Jerome's. Jerome is a notch above Doan when it comes to being able to create offense and put the puck in the net. Jerome's still a top goal scorer in the National Hockey League. Shane Doan isn't.
The Jerome situation, and I guess the franchise situation, they're kind of tied in, really, in a lot of people's minds, to the start of this hockey team. As you said, I mean, 0-2, you're not going to write anybody off. What is the start? What constitutes a start in this shortened season? Something that I think we're all kind of learning about here.
0-3 sucks. 1-4 sucks, and it puts you in a hole. This is game threes now, and game fours are pretty critical, because now you're looking at a week and a half to dig yourself out, and that means that you got to go almost perfect in the second week. We know how hard it is. You know, the CBA didn't change the 3-point game. It didn't change feeling good after an overtime loss. Those points are good, and they're critical. And if you don't get off to a good start, even though you might be 3 or 4 points out, and hey, who better to know that than the Calgary Flames, right? Being out 3 or 4 points and trying to jump over 3 teams to get to a playoff spot, it doesn't happen. All those teams ahead of you have to lose at the same time, and they're not. They're winning, or they're picking up points in overtime losses or shootouts. So this is a big one. Against the Vancouver Canucks, this is a very big hockey game.
Thanks, Kip. Appreciate your time. We'll do it again soon.
All right, guys.
You bet.
Have fun.
Nick Kyprios from Sportsnet, his comments from a day ago and his comments today. And, hey, the Flames don't need to talk about it. Jerome doesn't need to talk about it, but it's not going away. And if they win hockey games, if the Flames are in a playoff spot and they're winning, they're looking to add guys at the trade deadline, then, yeah, it gets in the background. Becomes a little bit of white noise on the periphery. But if they do not win games, and if they find themselves on the outside looking in, then we're going to be right in the thick of it. Because more than ever, we've talked about it last year, we talked about it the year before, but now more than ever, with an expiring contract on Jerome, it will be a major talking point around the league. He will be the focus of the trade deadline if, in fact, the Flames are not in a position.
Yeah, if you start 1-5 or 1-4, even tonight, 0-3, just get ready for it. I mean, because the National... We feel like we discuss it, you know, all the time, and we've kind of explored every avenue. The national media is waiting. I'm not saying they hate the Flames, they're cheering against the Flames. They're waiting and watching. If this team gets off to a bad start, it is going to be a massive story.
Earlier this week, I guess it would have been on Friday, we debuted the sarcastic player profile. You went after Patrick Marleau. The player profile got some play in the San Jose newspaper.
It's true.
The first, you were one for one in upsetting or at least getting the attention.
M-A-R-L-O. Marleau.
When we come back, you've done it again. Sportsnet 960, The Fan.
Calgary's number one destination for sports. Now and always. This is Sportsnet 960, The Fan.
We're heading towards 10 o'clock. Jim Rome, the big show, live from Shanks. It is a game day for the Calgary Flames. Your game day sponsor is South Point Toyota Scion. I've said this before, we are now 3 days into the NHL season, and we introduced a new segment. It is called the Sarcastic Player Profile. Now, some of the Flames fans are unhappy because it's not gone well for the Flames. The players you've picked upon, as we've laid out by now in great detail. Patrick Marleau with the Sharks, Andrew Cogliano with the Ducks. Both players, respectively, have put up 2-point nights against the Flames that evening.
Right.
And the Flames have lost both.
Yeah.
There are a lot of Flames fans who are saying ixnay. You're Jinxie McGillicuddy.
No.
And basically,
it's superstitious tripe.
People
and,
are at
it,
the...
It's dribble.
They're at the point that basically they're convinced that whoever you pick will have a breakout night.
Not true.
It's Vancouver tonight, which means our latest edition of the Sarcastic Player Profile.
It's the Sarcastic Player Profile with our little ray of sunshine, Andrew Walker, Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
July 1st, free agent frenzy. A chance to add a big name. Shea Weber, Ryan Suter. Who needs those chumps on the blue line? Not when Jason Garrison is available. The Vancouver Canucks thought the same thing and gave Garrison a 6-year, $27.6 million deal. Talk about thrifty. The key to Garrison's game is his versatility. His list of positive attributes are as follows. A booming slap shot. The signing already appears to be paying off as Garrison has registered a +1 rating through 2 games. Jason Garrison of the Vancouver Canucks, a goal-scoring, big-money defenseman coming from the Panthers. Hey, what could go wrong?
See, now again, the little tag there, it feels like it's a bit of a shot at potentially Jay Bouwmeester being a high-priced forward so goal-scoring.
Keith Ballard.
Wrong. Yeah, that notwithstanding, the Marleau comment that you made was picked up in the San Jose newspaper, in the Mercury... Whatever it is. Mercury News.
After Marleau had 2 goals here in the Sharks' opening night win over the Flames.
Marleau.
It was your attempt. What was it?
It was a satirical attempt at humor. And it should be particularly galling to us.
Very
galling to us who had the audacity to call out Patrick Marleau's heart and desire.
Yeah. So San Jose media picked up upon it. The Jason Garrison one that we ran earlier this morning.
Yeah, that didn't take long.
Has been picked up in the Vancouver media.
It usually takes a while for the Canucks-Flames rivalry to build. Not this year. 3 games into the season, and our sister station, the Fan 960 in Calgary, is mocking the Canucks and pricey free agent Jason Garrison.
His list of positive attributes are as follows. A booming slap shot.
What?
That's part of one of morning host Andrew Walker's sarcastic player profile. So why is he picking on Vancouver?
Flames fans absolutely hate the Canucks.
And the feeling is mutual. Jesse Johnston, News 11.
What? Did you do an interview?
They called me and asked about it. What am I
we
supposed
were
to do?
On the air.
Oh, it's a long show.
You did a phone interview about your bit during
Flames
our show.
Fans absolutely hate the Canucks.
It was a commercial break. It took like a minute. They phoned. What am I going to turn down? They phoned and asked, and I just said I gave them a quick comment and said it was all in fun.
Were you going to tell me about this or
I forgot about it? We were talking to Goose Gossage and Nick Kiprios and
now. You know this is going to get shut down.
Why would it ever get shut down?
I don't know, but you know it's... Who do they play on Saturday?
The Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah. I just know how this is going to go.
What? What? Another team is going to be offended?
Yes.
So far, it seems to be... And what?
Galling.
So far, it seems to be working out for all the other teams.
Well, not so good for the Flames.
Well, that'll change. Jason Garrison is not going to score tonight.
Jason Garrison. Might come through with a three-point effort tonight.
The Vancouver Canucks thought the same thing and gave Garrison a six-year, $27.6 million deal. Talk about thrifty.
Jeez.
Jason Garrison is not scoring tonight.
One goal, two apples.
If you're out there and if you think this has a bearing on something, you're ridiculous. You're ridiculous. Jason Garrison is not beating Kipper. Jason Garrison is not scoring tonight.
We are getting,
don't worry about it.
We are getting messages from people who have Garrison in their pools thanking you.
A goal-scoring, big-money defenseman coming from the Panthers. Hey, what could go wrong?
What's the worst that could happen?
So, there you go. 2 for 3 in terms of, if not irritating the other team, but getting under the skin of the other team's media. Tonight, Michael Backlund going to be centering the top line with Jerome Iginla and Mike Camilleri. I guess before we go, your thoughts, because we did kind of discuss it yesterday. Just didn't feel, and although Mike Camilleri had some points, you know, the other night and made a nice, you know, the shot off the redirect on the Glenn Cross goal, but Camilleri on the right side with Backlund and Berchi. Now, Backlund, Berchi, some chemistry, it seems. They will be broken up tonight, but to me, you had mentioned, and I agree 100%. We talked about it off the air, we talked about it on the air. Mike Camilleri can't just be a lost kind of an accent piece for two younger players. He's got to be an important cog in this wheel. He's a guy that can score. He's a guy that can contribute. You've got to find a way for him to produce.
Camilleri had a power play assist in the second game. 5-on-5 did not really have a sniff. Camilleri has to be a guy that's getting you chances. I mean, you can put anybody on this team is, the power play is going to be a boon to them. It really is. And you can put anybody on the power play and they can pick up some assists or whatever. 5-on-5, Mike Camilleri looked, and it wasn't necessarily on him, it didn't look like the right fit with Backlund and Berchi. And he was a little lost, he was a little perimeter. This guy has to be in a position of, you know, not bringing along a couple of younger guys, or, you know, he needs to be right up there, playing with a Jerome Iginla, playing with an Alex Tonga, something. You need to get him going. I think this is interesting. And then I also like Tongay between Glenn Cross and Stempniak. I really like that. Now, Stempniak is going to be there sometimes, and then when he cools down, he'll be right down in the bottom six. I think we all know that. But right now, Stempniak and Glenn Cross, who are streaky, are both hot. Put your best setup man there and see what you can do.
Stempniak with Glenn Cross and Tongay. Camilleri up top with Backlund and Iginla, the third line stage. And it will be Sven Berchi sliding to line three. Blake Como on the right side. Maybe Como can feed off of some of that Berchi energy, because through a couple games he's been noticeably unnoticeable, if that makes any sense. On the blue line, Mark Giordano with Jay Bouwmeester. At least these are the pairings that skated yesterday, and the only reason I bring him up is I wonder if we will see Chris Butler as a healthy scratch tonight. Or scratched, unless there's an injury we don't know about. However, TJ Brody with Weidman, Smith, and Sarich. Sarich would draw back in, which would seem to leave Butler as the odd guy out. Does that surprise you in any way?
Yes. Yes, it does.
A little bit to me, too. But, again, I know it's Warner mentioned the dollars he's making. He's easy to sit. I suppose there is that. And at the end of the day, no one has played so well that you can say, how dare Bob Hartley take him out of the lineup.
Right.
They haven't played well enough.
Yeah, he's looking at different lines. He's looking at different combos. You know what? Unfortunately, this is what you do in the preseason, right? And
yeah.
Every team's in the same boat, so it's not an excuse. But, you know, experimenting and seeing who works with what and, you know, what kind of identity you want. This is why you get 7 preseason games. And right now, with the new coach and having to try stuff and getting 2 new players back in the lineup Saturday, boy, I mean, you don't have much room for error anymore.
The 2 new players you talk about, Roman Cervenka and Yuri Hudler, both are back in Calgary. Hudler from the unfortunate loss of his father, Cervenka from the Mayo Clinic in Arizona, where he has been cleared and can start to, he'll be cleared, ready to go Thursday. Hudler will be put on the active roster today. Neither will play tonight, both at the discretion of the head coach in time for Saturday. And I would guess, regardless of what happens tonight, win or lose, like you say, abbreviated season, we brought in Cervenka, let's get him in there. He doesn't need to play 20 minutes a night. But he is, at this point, it would seem, your best centerman who has yet to play a game.
Yeah, maybe.
Right?
We have no way of knowing.
The afternoon we'll show from Shanks up north. They are up north right now, right? They do the first, or what are they?
They're south the entire south. Season.
That's right. Yeah. They don't have...
Entire season. Shanks show. McLeod Trail South.
There you go. Patty and Lubardi's going to be doing it from Shanks. The place to watch the Calgary Flames tonight. 8 o'clock start. We'll have Flames warm-up going at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow on the show, it's a Thursday. We will have Eric Duhatchik dropping by as well. We got Stephen Brunt tomorrow as well. Stephen Brunt comes by on a Thursday from the Dominican Republic. So we hate him already for that. And most importantly, and probably most intriguing, the fury and hate that you will receive from listeners, texters, and emailers if, in fact, Jason Garrison comes through with a multi-point effort tonight.
Flames win tonight. No, Garrison. Don't worry about it. And everyone can get back on board with the sarcasm.
Your batting average is stellar through two games. Can't believe you did a Vancouver radio show.
I didn't do a show. They called me for a comment. What am I supposed to say? No and hang up?
That's what I do.
No, yeah.
Stations are looking for interviews.
Bad person.
We're coming back with the Jim Rome Show next. Sports at 960, The Fan.
Flames fans absolutely hate the Canucks.
And the feeling is mutual.
30 teams in the NHL. We cover them all. Home for the world's fastest game. Sportsnet 960, The Fan.